Slaves are like other people and imbibe prejudices quite common to others. They think their own better than that of others. Many, under the influence of this prejudice, think their own masters are better than the masters of other slaves. And this, too, in some cases, when the very reverse is true. Indeed, it is not uncommon for slaves even to fall out and quarrel among themselves about the relative goodness of their masters, each contending for the superior goodness of his own over that of the others. It was so in our plantation. When Colonel Lloyd's slaves met the slaves of Jacob Jepson, they seldom parted without a quarrel about their masters. Colonel Lloyd's slaves contending that he was the richest, and Mr. Jepson's slaves that he was the smartest, and most of a man. Colonel Lloyd's slaves would boast his ability to buy and sell Jacob Jepson. Mr. Jepson's slaves would boast his ability to whip Colonel Lloyd. These quarrels would almost always end in a fight between the parties, and those that whipped were supposed to have gained the point at issue. They seemed to think that the greatness of their masters was transferable to themselves. It was considered as being bad enough to be a slave, but to be a poor man's slave was deemed a disgrace indeed. Well, my man Frederick Douglass is saying here is some heavy stuff. It just goes to show you that as much as slavery messed up people's bodies, it messed up their minds even more. It was bad enough that black people had to work for nothing for Colonel Lloyd, Jacob Jepson, and hundreds of thousands of other evil men just like them. It was bad enough that we got whipped and sold away from our parents and children and husbands and wives. It was bad enough that our lives were not our own. But what's worse than that is that slaves who identified with their masters as if the slaves' value as human beings depended on what the masters were like. What they were like was evil. They were called masters because they owned human beings. And we slaves were ready to fight each other over which of the low-down, filthy dogs who owned us was the best. But it wasn't the slaves' fault. Like Douglass wrote, slaves are like other people. When you think about it, it's a wonder more black folks didn't fight with one another instead of fighting against the white man the way Denmark Vesey, Nat Turner, David Walker, and a whole lot of others did. While you're busy shaking your head over some dumb slaves, ask yourself this. Are we any better today? Black people put on the uniform of the U.S. military, our masters, and go to Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, and anywhere else Uncle Sam tells us to go, and fight and kill yellow-skinned folks and brown-skinned folks on behalf of the United States, our masters, just like slaves fighting other slaves. Meanwhile, back home, one out of every half dozen blacks is locked up for committing the same drug crimes as white dudes who walk around free. What's wrong with that picture? Then you've got black folks in police uniforms out there arresting other blacks. Blacks in America really need to study the Jews in Germany. Those Jews never thought they were part of Hitler's system. They never sided with the people oppressing them. We do. We go to war. What kind of abomination is that? How many blacks go to war because we can't find a job and are willing to kill or be killed just so we can feed ourselves and our families? Getting back to Frederick Douglass, it's like he said, slaves are like other people. Too many of us have that slave mentality. It can take a lot to get past that, but a lot of us have, and Frederick Douglass was one. He was born into slavery, 1818, in Maryland. He wasn't with his mother long enough to remember her very well, and the only thing he knew about his father was that he may have been the man who owned him. Douglass shows what you can accomplish when your mind is free. He was somewhat free. A black woman purchased Frederick Douglass's freedom. He married the black woman, Anna, but he spent most of his time running around with German women, ignoring his uneducated wife. He was taught to read when he was 8 years old by one of his owners, a white lady. What he didn't learn from her, he picked up himself, sometimes by tricking white boys into showing him how to read and write words. When he got a little bit older, his rebelliousness came to the surface. Most teenagers start to rebel, but Douglass was one teenager with something to rebel against. He got a hold of some anti-slavery writings, and that fed his anger even more. Soon this got to be too much for his owner, who sent him to another plantation so they could break him. That only made Douglass more determined. A slave driver, Mr. Covey, beat him one day till he was covered in blood, but but the next time he tried to lay a hand on him, he had a fight on his hands. It lasted a good couple of hours. This time, Covey was the one doing the bleeding. He never came near Douglas again. As Douglas wrote in his narrative, "This battle with Mr. Covey was the turning point in my career as a slave." Career as a slave. That cracks me up. Fred had a sense of humor. Books say he escaped from slavery in 1838, when he was 20, using Seaman's papers he had borrowed, then gave lectures for money for the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society. Later he started his own anti-slavery newspaper, the North Star, in 1847. In 1852, on a day after Independence Day, Douglas gave a speech for the Ladies Anti-Slavery Society in Rochester, New York. The speech was later called, "What to the Slave is the Fourth of July?" Douglas talked about Americans' most special holiday, and he told it exactly like it was. He started off so nice and meek that he almost seemed to be apologizing for being there. But then when he got all those white folks all relaxed and comfortable, he sprang this on them. "Fellow citizens, pardon me, allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? If so, there's a parallel to your conduct." That was Fred. All white folks had to do was teach him to use their language, and he was able to use it a lot better than most of them ever would. After the Civil War started, he helped recruit black soldiers for the 54th Massachusetts Infantry Regiment to fight against the South in slavery. Years later, after the war was over, the president appointed him minister to Haiti. Fred was one black man who believed in himself and his own potential. Not bad for a dude who started off as somebody else's property, right? Harriet Tubman. The U.S. Treasury Department has been talking about putting a sister on the $20 bill. Harriet Tubman. You know, if anything like that happens, black folks had nothing to do with it, because if we did, her picture would be lighter and her hair would be permed. Because that's how we think. But when you stop and think about Harriet Tubman and the reason we know about her, white historians picked the woman they wanted. You think out of a million of blacks who were slaves, there was only one woman out there helping slaves escape? They picked the one they wanted, and then they told us, "Now you leave us alone, okay? See if you can find another one. You ain't got half enough money to do the research, and if you don't do the research, you can't find out." When we stop and think about where we are, we realize we have to challenge everything folks say, even when it sounds good, like putting Harriet Tubman on a $20 bill. Now, that's not to take anything away from Harriet Tubman. She was a hero, sure enough. She was a little slip of a woman, wasn't big as a minute, couldn't read or write. All her life she had dizzy spells because she once got hit in the head with a piece of metal a slave owner had chucked at another slave. That doesn't sound much like somebody who could lead runaway slaves to Canada, does it? But she did, and if you were one of the slaves she was taking and you got scared and wanted to turn back, she'd pull out a pistol and threaten to shoot you. She may have been a little woman, but she was a serious little woman. She was born with the name Araminta Harriet Ross in 1822. She had 8 brothers and sisters. Like Frederick Douglass, she was a rebel. One time she stole some sugar and thought her owner was going to beat her for it, so she hid for 5 days. She had no love for slavery, and getting hit on the head with that piece of metal didn't help. Things like that, plus seeing family members sold away, made her decide she needed to escape. By then, she had a husband, John Tubman, but when he wouldn't run away with her, and she couldn't get anybody else in the family to go with her, she took off by herself. She made it to New Jersey on foot and became a paid domestic worker. Then she decided she wanted to sneak back down south and free her family, too. She started with her parents, who were old at that point. Before she was done, she had freed a whole bunch of slaves. Nobody knows how many. Some say around 150. Some say 300. They called her Black Moses because she freed her people like Moses in the Bible freed the Hebrews from Egypt. Except in the case of Moses, we have to take the Bible's word for it. There are pictures of Harriet Tubman. She was a spy, too. During the Civil War, when the white officers needed to know what was going on down south, they'd send free blacks like Harriet because they could pass as slaves. Nobody'd think twice about seeing one more black person, especially one who looked as little and harmless as Harriet Tubman. We shouldn't be underestimated. Eli Whitney and the Cotton Gin. Now, they tell you that a white man named Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin in 1793 and put a patent on it the next year. The cotton gin is a machine that separates cotton from cotton seeds. Up until then, black people, slaves, had to do that by hand. The slaves worked themselves to death picking the stuff, but slave owners didn't care, because they didn't care about anything when it came to slaves, as long as those slaves were working. But they say a white man invented the cotton gin so the job would be easier. If you never liked me, then why would you invent a cotton gin to ease my burden? The only people who care how hard it is are the people doing it. That's why when Eli Whitney went to Virginia to visit his mother and father's friend, he saw these slaves sitting out there with this device we now call the cotton gin, and he went back and put a patent on it. The Dred Scott decision. It's funny how much a thing can change and still be called the same thing. Let's say a boy is born. His mama and daddy name him John. When John is a little baby boy, he's just as cute as anything you ever saw. Laughing and giggling. And he's even cuter when he gets a couple years older, trying to walk and talk. You just want to eat him up. Now go forward 90, 95 years. His name is still John. But the resemblance ends there. John is as mean as a wet hen, ugly as homemade sin. His skin sagging, pooping in his drawers, so evil his own mama wouldn't claim him, even if she weren't cold in the ground already. John doesn't have one thing in this world in common with that cute little boy from so long ago. But his name is still John. You know what else is like that? The Republican Party. Republicans today are the most self-serving sons of whores on the planet, but they still like to call themselves the Party of Lincoln. They should have to pay a fine every time they say that because it's nothing but a lie. Today, almost all black folks know better than to vote for Republicans, which would be like chickens voting for a fox. But when Lincoln was around, the Republican Party was one of the best friends that black people had. Look at what was happening in the first half of the 1800s, the decades before the Civil War. The country didn't know what to do about slavery. The South wanted it and the North didn't, and the two sides kept coming up with agreements that didn't work out. The Missouri Compromise of 1820 made it so there couldn't be slavery in the Louisiana Territory north of a certain point. Both sides agreed. Then in 1854, Congress passed the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which let people living in the new territories of Kansas and Nebraska decide for themselves what to do about the issue of slavery. Because Kansas and Nebraska were in the old Louisiana Territory, and because they were north of where the Missouri Compromise said there couldn't be slavery, passing the Kansas-Nebraska Act was about the same as tearing up the Missouri Compromise into little pieces. The pro-slavery folks were happy. The anti-slavery folks were pissed off. And those pissed off folks, the ones who wanted no parts of slavery, were the ones who started the Republican Party. You think if Donald Trump had been around in 1854, he would have been unhappy with the Kansas-Nebraska Act? Or Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell? Dream on. Then came the Dred Scott decision in 1857. It was a huge case, man. Dred Scott was a slave in Missouri. His master moved for a while to a spot in the northern part of the Louisiana Territory and took Scott with him. They later went back to Missouri. After that, Scott sued his master. He said that since he had been on soil that was supposed to be free, he was now a free man. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. The court pretty much told Dred Scott, "Screw you. Why are you wasting our time with this mess? You're a black man and a slave. You ain't got no rights." They used fancier words than that, but it worked out to the same thing. It seemed that the highest court in the land was on the side of slavery, and that made the anti-slavery folks mighty depressed. All of them except Frederick Douglass. His view was pretty much, "Look, all this means is if we want to get rid of slavery, we can't do it with little agreements on pieces of paper. Something big has got to happen." He was right, and something big did happen. A couple of things. First was John Brown's 1859 raid on Harper's Ferry, which I'll get to in just a minute. Then, in 1860, the new Republican Party's man, Abraham Lincoln, got elected. In 1863, Lincoln freed the slaves, on paper anyway, with the Emancipation Proclamation. And then they got free for real when the North kicked the South's evil, redneck, racist, slave-owning behind in the Civil War, and the South surrendered in 1865. As bad as the Dred Scott decision was, it helped folks see what needed to happen. John Brown and the outbreak of the Civil War. There wouldn't have been a Civil War without John Brown. People will say, "Oh, John Brown was crazy." You ask them, "Why you say that?" And they'll say, "Well, look at what he did in Kansas." What did he do in Kansas? He killed people in Kansas. Yeah, but do you know why he did it? Today, when they have presidential elections, people talk about battleground states. Man, let me tell you, folks today don't know what a battleground state is all about. As I mentioned earlier, in 1854, the U.S. government passed the Kansas-Nebraska Act. That meant that some land they stole from Native Americans would be the U.S. territories that became the states of Kansas and Nebraska. It also meant that the people who lived there could decide whether the states would be free or slave states. Folks from both sides moved to Kansas ready to fight. I don't mean argue. I mean they got ready to shoot and cut one another to death, and that's what some of them ended up doing. Now that's a battleground state. Well, one of the people who went there was John Brown. After some dirty pro-slavery dogs raided Lawrence, Kansas and tore up the offices of some abolitionist newspapers and went crazy looting the rest of the town, John Brown and his men came in and killed 5 pro-slavery men, hacked them to death. That same year, 1856, Brown and his men, including his sons, fought against the pro-slavery forces at the Battle of Black Jack and the Battle of Osawatomie. That was John Brown. I'm not talking about some poor chump who joins the army just so he can make a living and then go out to kill whomever the government tells him to kill. I'm talking about a man who had a belief so strong that he was willing to die for it. I've said it once before. White is not a color. It's an attitude. By skin color, John Brown was a white man, but he may have been the best friend black folks ever had. He believed that slavery was straight up evil, and he didn't want to hear about peaceful opposition to slavery. He knew it would take action to get rid of that mess. In 1859, when he decided to raid Harper's Ferry in Virginia, now in West Virginia, he had 21 people with him, 5 of them black. Now, Harper's Ferry was the U.S. government munitions place where weapons were made, so it was full of military rifles and bullets. The government had 4 divisions of troops guarding it. Brown and fewer than 2 dozen men got in there, killed 4 people, wounded a bunch more, and held the soldiers off for 2 days. 2 days before the soldiers could break in the engine room where John Brown and his men were holed up. Now there's a reason I would place John Brown as number 1 if I had to make out a list of the 50 most important people who ever lived in the history of planet Earth. Jesus came here to die for my sins. John Brown didn't. Here is a man who not only decided to kill for me and die for me, but he took his own sons with him. You can't risk more than that. You can't sacrifice more than that. Even now, I go to the site every year on my birthday, and then I go back on October 16th. That's the day of the raid. And then I go on December 2nd, which is the day they hanged him. You think Lincoln didn't know what he was doing when he put that statue at the White House facing east? He put that there on December 2nd. He didn't say it was in honor of John Brown. But think about it. When John Brown was about to die, somebody yelled up at him, "How you feel now, nigger lover?" He said, "What I'm dying for, if I was defending rich white men, I'd be your hero." And when he hit the last step up to the gallows and the noose they were going to hang him with, he said, "Oh, by the way, I talked to God last night, and God told me to tell you that you missed the last chance of freeing the Negro without bloodshed." Brown continued, "The Negro would be freed, and it would be the biggest bloodbath in the history of war." The American Civil War was the first war in history where soldiers on both sides had gone to the same school, West Point. They knew each other's strategies. That's why the war dragged on like that. There hadn't ever been a war like that. That was some nasty stuff. The two sides would stand there and shoot at each other, and when they ran out of bullets, then the real thing started, charging at each other and scooping out each other's guts with those bayonets, until the ground and everybody on it was covered in red. If there's a hell, it must look a lot like that. It was because of John Brown. They killed John Brown, and 18 months later, the war started, because after what Brown and his men did, there was no turning back. Slavery was going to end, or it was going to continue. But either way, the question of slavery was going to be decided through bloodshed. And during the war, what were the Northern soldiers singing? "John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave." Not "God Bless America," but "John Brown's body." You see, racist whites weren't satisfied with just killing John Brown. After he was dead, they sent word, "We're not going to let John Brown's body get back to New York." When black men heard that, we lined the roads from Harper's Ferry to that little town in New York where Brown was buried. Lined the roads, shoulder to shoulder, saying, "Come on, y'all, come on, just try to get him." And that's how Brown's body got back home. Black men saying, "You think you're going to stop something? You will over our dead bodies." The 54th Massachusetts Infantry Regiment. Next time you hear some redneck idiot say, "Black people don't want to do anything to help themselves," tell them about the black soldiers who enlisted in the Union Army during the Civil War. See what he has to say then. Some folks would have you believe that exactly two blacks fought in the war, Morgan Freeman and Denzel Washington, because that's whom everybody remembers from the movie Glory. Truth is, 186,000 black soldiers enlisted. Around 50,000 came from free states, and another 40,000 came from what they called border states. Those are slave states that hadn't seceded from the Union. In those states, some fought for the Union, some for the Confederacy, but the biggest number of black soldiers, about 93,000, came from the southern states that had left the Union. All of them were called the United States Colored Troops. Mostly they were led by white officers. The white officers weren't exactly fighting each other over the chance to command the blacks. That changed, though, after the blacks proved they could fight well and bravely and after their regiments started to make a name for themselves. Just like anything else, something starts to get popular and all of a sudden everybody wants to have something to do with it, or else they claim they already do. It was no different with the black soldiers. Four men from the all-black 54th Massachusetts Infantry. That's the regiment whose story is told in Glory. Won medals for gallantry after the assault on Fort Wagner on Morris Island, South Carolina in July 1863. They were gallant, all right? A whole bunch of them gave up their lives. Just like with everything else black folks tried to do in those days, the first thing black soldiers had to do was convince white folks that we were up to the job. At first, the Union didn't want black soldiers. When the Civil War was heading into its third year and the South was showing no signs of giving up, getting help from black soldiers finally started to seem like a good idea. After Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing the slaves, a black leader in Boston named Lewis Hayton convinced the abolitionist governor of Massachusetts, John Andrew, to put together a regiment of black soldiers. That's how the 54th was born. A Union general, Quincy Gilmore, wanted to capture South Carolina, which a lot of folks thought of as the heart of the Confederacy. To do that, they had to get past a few strongholds, and one of the strongest was Fort Wagner. Trying to take out Wagner was like trying to knock somebody out in a boxing ring. That is, if the ring were hip deep in water and sand, and your opponent were wearing body armor. Wagner was on a strip of land with the Atlantic on one side and a swamp on the other. The fort was 30 feet high, 250 by 100 yards in size, and made of sand. That might not sound very strong, but it was fortified with logs and sandbags, and it had wooden spikes in front of it, spikes sharp enough to go right through you, plus landmines. Step on one of those and it'd be the last step you ever took in this life. Wagner had a moat around it, too. And did I mention the 14 cannons sticking out of it? I give those Southern folks this much. They knew how to play defense. The Union wasn't stupid. They knew if they just charged Fort Wagner, they'd get shot down like ducks. So before they did, they tried firing shells at it. Problem was, Wagner had what they called a bomb-proof roof beams with 10 feet of sand on top of them. The 54th spent most of the day shooting shells at that thing, and after about 11 hours it was still standing. Still, the Union figured they had softened it up enough so the soldiers could take it. That's where the 54th came in. One of them was Lewis Henry Douglas, Frederick Douglass's son. They were commanded by Colonel Robert Goldshaw, skinny white dude, wasn't but 25 years old. His parents were abolitionists. At that point, Colonel Shaw ordered 624 men from the 54th to quick march in with muskets and bayonets. As they got closer to Fort Wagner, they started to jog. When they were close enough, the Confederates inside the fort fired on them. Some from the 54th fell, but the others kept going. The wooden spikes didn't stop them. They climbed right over that crap. The moat didn't stop them either. All the shelling had half filled it with sand. But the Confederates didn't stop firing either. The 54th got mowed down. Colonel Shaw got killed too, as did the wave of soldiers the Union sent in after the 54th. When it was all over, the fort still hadn't fallen. The 54th didn't succeed that day, but they were as brave as all hell, and they were fighting for black folks' freedom and for the country to keep it in one piece, North and South. They made the biggest sacrifice you can make. Jocko. The way something looks is not always the way it is, and what white folks say is definitely not always the truth. Do I really have to remind you of that? For instance, when I was a boy, a friend of mine and I used to go out in the suburbs and throw bricks at those little black jockeys. You know, the ones you see holding lanterns on white folks' lawns. Then one day I said, "Hey, man, something's not right about this. Jockeys don't carry lanterns." We decided to see what was up. We got to looking and looking and looking, and then I found out that the jockey who started it all, the one behind those statues, wasn't a jockey at all. He was a 14-year-old boy, and are you ready? General George Washington's number one war strategist. Name was Jocko Graves. He was the son of Tom Graves, a free black man in Washington's army. Jocko wanted to fight in the army, too, but he was too young. That didn't stop him from traveling with Washington and the troops. That little black boy wanted to go, so he went. Simple as that. One morning, Jocko saw General Washington, and it looked like something was bothering him, so Jocko said, "What's wrong, Pop?" Washington said, "Ah, nothing." Jocko said, "Come on. You worried about something?" Washington told him, "We think the British are going to come in at this point, down here, and we'll be waiting for them. But there's also a possibility they'll come in over there. I can't divide my troops. The little 14-year-old said, "Don't worry, I think you're right, but give me that lantern. If they come that way, I can see them if they come around that bend." It turned out George Washington was right. His army battled the British all night, killed them all. When Washington ran over to where Jocko was holding that lantern to keep a lookout for the British, he saw that the boy had frozen to death. Now that's loyalty. That's why I say you can't trust what folks tell you. They reduced that story down to just some little tall black jockey-looking kid holding a lantern on white folks' lawns, when the real story is about loyalty. 14-year-old black boy froze to death protecting the American revolutionaries. Even the white folks who know the story tell it wrong. According to them, Jocko froze to death holding the reins of Washington's horses. This shows Jocko's loyalty, but holding reins didn't require brains. Don't pay attention to that mess. The assassination of Abraham Lincoln. People talk about Abraham Lincoln like he was the best friend black folks ever had because he freed the slaves. Lincoln didn't care a thing about black folks, and he sure wasn't their best friend. Now, you can look this up. Lincoln met with a room full of black men in the White House and told them they weren't as smart as white folks. One of his ideas for what to do after slavery was round up black folks and send them to another country. Think about your best friend. Would he or she tell you to your face you're as stupid as the day is long and then try to get you to move out of the country? If the answer is yes, you need a new best friend. Or else maybe your friend is right about the stupid part. Lincoln didn't care one way or another about black folks, or about slavery either. He wanted to preserve the Union, that's all. Here's what he said. "If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would do that." Now maybe that doesn't sound like somebody who hates black people. It doesn't exactly sound like somebody with their best interests at heart either, does it? Abraham Lincoln was a white man of his time. That's the long and the short of it. Folks say Lincoln got killed for freeing black folks. Maybe, maybe not. Think about this a minute. Lincoln was president during the Civil War, after the Southern states had seceded from the United States, and he had to find a way to preserve that Union he cared so much about. You know, the one blacks built for free during slavery. Now, it takes money to fight a war. If you're fighting in the army but you don't get paid, pretty soon you might just stop fighting. Plus, you got to eat. The government has to pay for all that. Well, the government didn't have enough money, so Lincoln went to banks in New York and asked to borrow what he needed. The bank said, "Sure, but you have to pay us back at 36% interest." That meant the U.S. government would have to pay the banks back every dime it borrowed, plus another one-third on top of that. That's like if you ask a neighbor to borrow his screwdriver, and he says, "Sure, you can borrow it, but when you bring it back, you've got to give me some screws along with it." Lincoln said, "Later for that." What did Lincoln do instead? He ordered the government to print money, called it greenbacks. Before that point in U.S. history, any time the government printed a dollar, it had to have a dollar's worth of gold to back it up. But with the North fighting a war and Lincoln needing a way to pay for it, in 1862, Lincoln said, "Go ahead and print money." That way the thinking went, the government wouldn't owe money to the banks. All this new money was floating around and the banks didn't have a thing to do with it. If you think the bank liked that, think again. Now go forward almost exactly 100 years when we had another president who was supposed to be a friend to black folks, John F. Kennedy. Comes into office, starting making all kinds of noise about what he's going to do for blacks. Of course, he didn't get a chance to do it, if that's what he was really going to do, because in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963, he was assassinated. All his plans fell to his vice president, Lyndon B. Johnson. People like to say Kennedy was killed for what he wanted to do for black folks. Maybe, maybe not. Look here. In 1963, Kennedy signed Executive Order Number 11110, which allowed the U.S. government, once again, to print money without going through the Federal Reserve Bank. In other words, the government could get money without owing one thin dime to the bankers. So once again, there was new money, but no action for the banks. The whole reason the Federal Reserve Bank exists is to lend money to the government and get paid back with interest. If it can't do that, it's out of business. If you think the Federal Reserve bankers wanted that, think again. Kennedy got killed later that year. Folks said it was because he supported civil rights, but he was also one of two presidents who tried to get around the banks. The other one was Abraham Lincoln. What do you think? Chapter 2. Solidarity. Free people are the ones with enough money to control the information the rest of us get. A white boy told me in the 1960s, "Man, the worst dude on the planet is a liberal." I didn't say anything. He explained, "Yeah," he said, "a right-winger decides he's gonna kill you. He takes his children to school every day, and he goes by the coffee shop and blows his brains out if a black person comes in the door because he can't stand to see it integrated. But see, when a liberal decides he's gonna kill you, he sees you go to football game every Saturday and says, 'Let's blow up the stadium.'" I don't know if this is true or pure crazy talk. Normally I would research a statement like this, but I don't really care. Seems his head is a little messed up. All white folks have to do is take a gorilla and spruce him up, and we black folks buy it. For instance, Bobby Kennedy was no good. No good. You only think he was good because you don't know. Remember Senator Joe McCarthy from Wisconsin? Bobby was his aide. He was the one that was digging up all that dirt on everybody during the Red Scare. That was Bobby. Americans are so fixated on the Kennedy glamour. Even black folks. We can't get trapped by what is not real. We can't believe in others. We have to believe in black solidarity. The point is, we can have help from white folks, but we can't rely on them. We have to organize ourselves. We've done so in the past, and we need to do it some more. In this section, I highlight ways in which blacks have organized and produced great outcomes. W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, and the Atlanta Compromise. Here's something that might seem strange. At the same time as some white folks were making things tough for black people in the South, other white folks couldn't throw money at blacks fast enough. Most of the money had to do with education. Some of the rich folks giving out all the money, the philanthropists, did it partly out of the goodness of their hearts. Some of them were church folks and were just trying to do their Christian duty. But some of them, especially the ones in the North, figured it this way. If folks in the South, including black folks, got enough education to get good jobs, they could pay their fair share of taxes. See there? With half of what goes on in life, if you dig down to the bottom to see what it's all about, you find money. With the other half, you find sex. But that's a different story. Here's how strange it was. After slavery came a dozen years of Reconstruction, and it seemed like a new day for black folks in the South. Because there were federal troops ensuring our rights, blacks could vote and run for office with little trouble, and there were even black senators and congressmen down South. Then came the presidential election of 1876. It was a close one. It looked like the Democrat Samuel Tilden had more votes in the Electoral College than the Republican Rutherford B. Hayes. Some said otherwise, because the vote in a few states was so close that nobody knew whom the state's electoral votes were going to. There wasn't a presidential election like that again until 124 years later, when George W. Bush ran against Al Gore in 2000. Finally, the Democrats said, "Okay, look here. Y'all can have the election. No problem. You just have to do us one favor. Take these federal troops out of the South. You know, the ones y'all got down here making sure blacks can vote and get elected to office. Let us deal with our black people our way." The Republicans said, "Cool." And that's how the Compromise of 1877 happened. Hayes became president, and just about the first thing he did was remove the troops from the South. And just like that, Reconstruction was over. Now here's the strange part. Rutherford B. Hayes, the dude who became president on the condition that he pulled federal troops out of the South and end Reconstruction, That same dude later helped run a fund that helped a dozen schools train black teachers. Isn't that some crazy stuff? Even after the government pulled the federal troops out of the South, and even after blacks got chased out of Congress with white dudes in hoods two steps behind them, and even when some blacks were getting locked up just for looking white folks in the eye, while all that was happening, black folks were going to school. If they couldn't do anything else for them, poor black parents were at least able to send their kids to school. One of those little kids was young Booker T. Washington. He was born in Virginia in 1856 as a slave. Then after emancipation, he went to school at the Hampton Institute in Virginia. That school was run by General Samuel Chapman Armstrong. And that's who gave old Booker T. the main idea he didn't let go of for the rest of his life. It was all about work. If you were working, you were staying out of trouble. The more work you did, the better you got at it. And the better you got, the more money you made, and the prouder you felt. The prouder you felt, the more you stayed out of trouble because you didn't want to mess it all up doing some low-down mess. The more money you made, the more property you would have. And the more property you had, the more you would have to keep and protect, so the harder you'd work. For Booker T., it all started and ended with work. Booker T. Washington believed that for black folks in the South, which is where most of them were at the time, the key was to find work that white folks needed done. That way, black folks would be useful to other people, and when other people needed you, you survived. Not just that. If black folks showed white folks we could work and be trusted, if we proved that our presence was good for white people, the whites might just let up on us and treat us like ordinary folks instead of animals. What kind of work did white folks need done? Farming and other manual labor. Stuff like that. See, Booker T. was all for blacks getting educated, as long as we got taught to do practical stuff. General Armstrong recommended Booker T. to head up the Tuskegee Institute, a school in Alabama for black folks that got started in the 1880s. Booker ran Tuskegee for the rest of his life. It gave his ideas a spotlight. He thought the most important thing was for blacks to get themselves together economically. Racial equality? Fighting for voting rights? Integrating with whites? The way Booker T. saw it, all that could wait. It was more important to work. You best believe white people ate that stuff up. Why wouldn't they have? They didn't have to change a thing they were doing, and black folks were going to help them. In 1895 in Georgia, Booker T. gave a famous talk that was known afterward as the Atlanta Compromise Speech. He said about blacks and whites, "In all things that are purely social, we can be as separate as the five fingers, yet one as the hand in all things essential to mutual progress." White people clapped at that till they couldn't feel their hands. Washington told blacks in the South that they should forget about going somewhere else to make a new start. They had opportunities right where they were. He said, "To those of my race who depend upon bettering their condition in a foreign land or who underestimate the importance of cultivating friendly relations with the Southern white man, I would say, cast down your bucket where you are. Cast it down in making friends in every manly way of the people of all races by whom we are surrounded. Cast it down in agriculture, mechanics, in commerce, in domestic service, and in the professions." You have to give old Booker T. Washington his due. What he was saying made some sense, even if you didn't agree with it. Of course, now it probably won't surprise you to hear that not all black people saw things the way he did. Some black folks heard what Booker T. was saying about doing what white folks needed done, and they said, "Later for that. The 14th Amendment says I'm a citizen. If I'm a citizen, I've got rights, and I should be able to do what I want. Forget about trying to do what the white folks need. That mess ended with slavery, or should have. Why have I got to try to be useful to the white man just so he won't treat me worse than he treats a dog? I've got my own life to think about. I need to be able to vote. That's my right as a citizen. If I want to spend my life studying philosophy or French or art history, I need to be able to do that. What I want doesn't have a thing to do with the white man." One brother who felt that way was William Edward Burghardt, Du Bois, W.E.B. for short. He was born in Massachusetts in 1868. Talk about a black man getting educated. After he got a degree at Fisk University, Du Bois went overseas to study in Berlin, then returned and became the first black person to get a Ph.D. from Harvard University. That man had brains coming out of his ears. One of Du Bois's books is The Souls of Black Folk, which you need to read if you haven't. Du Bois didn't like what Booker T. Washington was saying, and not just because he thought black people should be able to do whatever we wanted. The way Du Bois saw it, if all you told black people to do was work, work, and work some more, you were making them into machines instead of people. Hard to say he was wrong, just like it was hard to say Booker T. was wrong. In an essay called The Talented Tenth, Du Bois wrote, "If we make money the object of man training, we shall develop money makers, but not necessarily men. If we make technical skill the object of education, we may possess artisans, but not in nature men. Men we shall have only as we make manhood the object of the work of the schools. Intelligence, broad sympathy, knowledge of the world that was and is, and of the relation of men to it. This is the curriculum of that higher education which must underlie true life." Booker T. and Du Bois, they were both right. The founding of the NAACP. In the 19th century, black folks couldn't win for losing. Things looked good for a while. In 1863, President Abraham Lincoln announced the end of slavery with the Emancipation Proclamation, and the slaveholding states that made up the Confederacy lost the war in 1865. It was a new day for black folks, or at least it seemed that way. Reconstruction started but was short-lived. Black folks didn't go back to being slaves, and we still had the legal right to vote because of the 15th Amendment, which got passed in 1870. But that didn't stop Southerners from harassing blacks at the polls and making us take all kinds of stupid tests before we could get anywhere near a ballot box. So blacks could vote, but we couldn't vote. Now, it wasn't enough for some white folks that blacks were prevented from voting or serving in office. Because blacks weren't slaves anymore, we were getting jobs that whites felt entitled to. Whites didn't like that a bit. Plus, how could white folks feel they were better than blacks if blacks were free just like them? Some blacks had even been congressmen and senators. White folks didn't like that either. They started getting resentful, as if they were the ones who had something to be resentful about. They got so pissed off at blacks that they started lynching us. Between the mid-1880s and 1900, more than 2,500 folks were lynched. Most of these are black folks, and most of the lynchings were in the southern states. And those are just the ones we know about after they finally started keeping track. It wasn't just lynchings either. Sometimes whole black neighborhoods got burned down. If word got out that some black person had done some white person wrong, even if it hadn't happened, the next thing you knew, there was a white mob beating and killing the accused black person, torching his house. It didn't happen just in the South either. In Springfield, Illinois, in 1908, a couple of black dudes accused of rape and murder, which they hadn't committed, were transferred from one prison to another before a mob could lynch them. That pissed off the mob so bad, they burned up $200,000 worth of black folks' property. That was the racial climate at the time the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or the NAACP, got started. Folks today talk about climate change. Some climates change. Some don't. In 1909, the year after the Springfield riot, a group of black and white folks decided that enough was enough. Matter of fact, the white folks were the ones who called the first meeting. Only a handful of black folks were involved at the beginning, including Mary Church Terrell, Ida B. Wells, and W.E.B. Du Bois. Still, it wasn't as if black folks hadn't been active in our own defense up to that point. In 1905, Du Bois and another black man, William Monroe Trotter, had started the Niagara Movement to oppose discrimination and fight for black people's rights. But half the fighting the group did was with one another. They couldn't agree on which candidate to support for president or on other issues. Things got so bad that Trotter left the group in 1907, and by the time the NAACP formed, Du Bois told the handful of members left in the Niagara movement to throw their support behind the NAACP. Du Bois headed up the NAACP's magazine, The Crisis, which is still being published today. Now, hard as they tried, the NAACP couldn't get Congress to pass anti-lynching laws. There were too many racist congressmen and senators for that. And even if they weren't racist themselves, some of the voters in their districts were, and those voters had long memories. The NAACP did publish a report, 30 Years of Lynching in the United States, 1889 to 1919, that became the talk of the land and helped lead to a decline in the number of lynchings. The NAACP had its national office in New York City and field offices in Boston, Washington, Detroit, and other cities, and then it spread out even more. In the 1930s, when the Depression hit and the whole country was suffering, and blacks were suffering worse, the NAACP fought to get black folks jobs. The NAACP was also behind the cases that got combined in Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas in 1954, which was when the U.S. Supreme Court decided that school segregation and the Constitution didn't see eye to eye. Since then, the NAACP has been involved in activities ranging from the civil rights movement to the fight to get more black characters on TV shows like The West Wing. The Great Migration and the Urban League. In the 19th century, most black folks in America lived in the South. Early in the 20th century, we started moving north and west. A whole lot of things made us move. Here's one. Right after the Civil War ended, the southern states, starting with South Carolina and Mississippi, passed the Black Codes. Among other things, that meant if you were black and got called a vagrant, you would get arrested. It was pretty easy to get called a vagrant. Black people had to have written proof of employment on us at all times, and if we didn't, we could get arrested. We had to sign work contracts, and if we tried to get out of those contracts before the end of the year, we had to pay back the year's wages or get arrested. And not only did we have to work and prove we were working, but there were only a couple of kinds of work we could do. In South Carolina, if you were black and wanted a job as anything besides a farmer or a servant, you had to pay a tax, which most black folks couldn't afford. That way, white folks had guaranteed labor. Besides, who did you think you were trying to be something besides a servant, you uppity nigger, you? What happened when black people got arrested? That's the beautiful part. We still had to work, but now we had to do it for free again. Just like in slavery times. It was called convict leasing. Prisons would lease convicts out to companies for mining work and other dangerous, dirty jobs, and the convicts didn't get paid a cent. The only difference between that and slavery is this. If a slave master owned you, he didn't want you to die, because he'd paid money for you. But if you were a prisoner and got worked to death, there were plenty more where you came from. And when racist whites weren't trapping you, tricking you, and arresting you, they were up and killing you. So if you were black and living in the South and all that mess was going on, the North and West would have started looking pretty good, right? The only problem, besides having to leave behind your home and everything you ever knew, was the white bosses didn't want to let you go. They had other plans for you. It's nice to feel wanted, but not like that. So you couldn't just walk into work one day and tell your boss, "I quit. Going up north. Goodbye, you old racist dog, you." If you tried to do that, the boss would find a way to put you in jail or kill you. No, you had to get slick about it. Pretend you were just going out for a drive, then hop on that train and not look back. So now you're up north or out west, along with the more than 500,000 other black folks who between 1910 and 1920 alone had enough sense and balls to hightail it out of the South. Things are better where you've gone to, but it's not like New York City, Chicago, Philadelphia, or Los Angeles held a ticker tape parade for you and put up banners reading, "Welcome, Negro friends." Black folks still had to face the big three: segregation, discrimination, and poverty. In the only parts of town black folks could go to, we got charged too much money for places that were falling apart because landlords knew we couldn't go anywhere else. Racism in housing, racism in employment, racism in education, it was all there waiting for us. Just like with the NAACP, black and white folks got together and decided that that crap wasn't acceptable. For a while, it seemed that for every black person who had come north, there was a group trying to help them out. The Committee on Urban Conditions Among Negroes got started in 1910 in New York. Of course, we already had the Committee for the Improvement of Industrial Conditions Among Negroes in New York, which had come along in 1906. And did I mention that the National League for the Protection of Colored Women had been founded in 1905? Eventually, they all merged, but the new name, the National League on Urban Conditions Among Negroes, wasn't too much better. So in 1920, they shortened it to the National Urban League. That was more like it. And that group has been around ever since, helping black folks fight discrimination in education, jobs, housing, and health care. Congress of Racial Equality, CORE. Now, you can't really understand Martin Luther King Jr. until you know a little something about Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi was Indian. For a bald little man with no teeth, he was a mighty strong dude, leading the Indian people to their independence from Britain, which they finally got in 1947. He did it through what he called non-cooperation and passive resistance. Gandhi didn't want violence. His whole thing was this: Britain couldn't keep on ruling India without Indians' cooperation, so what Indians had to do was just stop cooperating. It was simple and beautiful. Don't hit anybody, but just don't do what they tell you to do. And the plan worked. Indians stopped buying the stuff Britain made, stopped going to school, stopped going to work, and went to jail until the jails couldn't hold one more Indian. Finally, the British said, "All right, enough, you win." A lot of people know that Gandhi influenced Martin Luther King Jr.'s philosophy of nonviolent resistance in the civil rights movement. What a lot of people don't know is how many others Gandhi influenced. One group that admired his teachings was the Congress of Racial Equality, which got started in Chicago in 1942. Called the Committee of Racial Equality at first, CORE was an integrated group. One of the original members was a black man, James Farmer. The group came out of another organization, the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Like Gandhi, the group was dedicated to nonviolent action. It succeeded in integrating public places in the North through sit-ins like the ones that would become famous in the South. At first, CORE wasn't merely pacifist or nonviolent. Its members didn't believe in hierarchies either. In other words, nobody was really in charge. That became a problem when the group started to expand nationwide. Ever been to a meeting where nobody's in charge? It's cool and everything until you try to get something done. Then you realize you've got a problem. Finally, the national organization took a firm hand and told the local chapters to fall in line. James Farmer became president in 1953. Things heated up when the group started being active in the South. In 1960, the U.S. Supreme Court had declared that segregation in interstate bus travel was unconstitutional. CORE decided to test out if that ruling was being enforced, sending groups of blacks and whites together on buses headed south. Those are some brave folks. They were beaten by mobs and the buses were set on fire. And the only thing the local police did was throw some of the riders in jail. Still, the freedom rides, that's what we call them, went on. And they worked. In fact, there was such an uproar over the Freedom Riders' treatment in the South that the Interstate Commerce Commission finally ended segregation of buses and travel facilities, including restrooms. CORE was involved in voter registration drives in the South, too. Three of the CORE workers in Mississippi during the Freedom Summer, 1964, were James Cheney, a young black man, and two young white dudes, Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner. For their trouble, they were beaten and murdered by the Ku Klux Klan with the cooperation of the local police. So the next time it's election day and you're too tired to make it to the voting booth, or you've got other plans, or you just don't feel like it, or you have some other lame excuse, think about the folks who got beaten and risked death and gave up their lives so people who looked like you could cast a ballot.